So, Kevin, you say that choice one is your antidote to stress. It lets you enjoy the stargazing without feeling stressed about the departure. But isn't it kind of a setup for stress later? You're going to get back in the airplane. You're going to take off. You might not know what the weather is like. You probably won't know what the weather's like until you're climbing out. And it'll be easy if Bar Harbor is fogged in or completely clear. You'll divert or you'll go for it. But what if it's in the in-between? If it's 5 miles in mist? It's easy to say you'll divert, but once you're only 22 minutes away, what's going to keep you from taking a peek that could end in disaster?
Well, a lot of that, I think, is going to depend for me on how I'm feeling at that moment when we depart. If I'm feeling as bright-eyed and bushy-tailed as I was hoping I would, then if it's calling for that 5 miles visibility, or if it's reporting 5 miles visibility, then I am going to go take a peek. But if it's fogged in, then it's not just that I have a plan. It's that I've had the conversation with the family about, hey, here's the risk that we're looking at for the evening, for the plans. Here's what might mess up our plans. And here's how we're going to deal with that. Here's our way out if we're going to do that. And then talking to the family about that, that maybe that could be something that causes the family to say, yeah, you have fun. We'll see you tomorrow. Or maybe they say, oh, okay, well, that thanks for telling me, and I understand what we're looking at. So, all right, well, maybe we wind up in Portland tonight, or maybe we wind up somewhere we didn't plan on, but it'll be a fun family adventure, and cool, whatever. So that part of it I wouldn't stress about, only because the family's been part of the planning process, or is at least looped in, and they know what's at stake.
Well, I like that idea of managing expectations in there, and you at least have the benefit you've been traveling with your family quite a bit here. Let me stay with you just for a second, Kevin. Would you use the word risk with your family, or would you lay it out like, this is the plan, I'm not sure where we're going to land tonight, and it's a big adventure? How do you manage expectations?
I think the word risk is acceptable if you're using it in the right context. I think as long as you're presenting it to the family like, geez, we might actually have to pull a parachute tonight. Won't that be crazy? Then I think that would be a terrible idea to bring up to the family. I don't think that inspires confidence. But in terms of the risk or chances that you might not make it back into your first choice airport to get back into, and as long as you're able to have a frank discussion about that might happen, that sort of thing is a risk. Anytime you're out late at night like that, it happens. I've had it happen to me. To have a risk that way, or to have a discussion that way and be flying at night, I don't see any issue with looping the family in and having them be part of that discussion, and they can decide for themselves if they're as excited as I am about the meteor shower.
Elaine, you've decided to head out there, but you're going to come back early. That cuts the benefit for sure, because the best viewing is going to be later in the evening. Does it really reduce risk? What's your motivation for doing that? Why is that a good choice?
I think that if you plan to leave early and then kind of keep an eye on things and know, okay, it can be another 10, 15 minutes. I think if you tell everyone this could be as short as a 30 to 45 minute stargazing event, everyone will be okay. If we need to head back early, that would be fine. As was discussed with having the contingency plan that everyone is on the same page with, and the likelihood of diverting would be less at this point. Knowing that your plan B would be flying to Bangor or doing something else, and I kind of combine that possibly with number five, where, you know, if we have to cut it short, we'll see a little bit and maybe check it out another night. I don't see a problem with doing that as well, and knowing that it could end up being a little bit longer stay out there than you plan. But just setting that stage would help everybody enjoy even what would be a shorter event.
Catherine, you're camping. First, I got to say, I live in Maine. Mosquitoes around here could actually carry you away. They are brutal. Aren't you setting yourself up for a situation where you're out there, the bugs are awful, everybody's complaining, and you're like, no, we're not flying back or finding a motel at 3 a.m. Or you have a terrible night's sleep, and now you've got to fly back in the morning, it's daylight, but you've hardly slept at all, and everyone's counting on you. Isn't that a setup for later on things falling apart?
Well, let me back up and say that the reason that I chose option four has almost nothing to do with the fact that there's possibly fog in the area. Let's back up. You have put four people in an SR-22, and it is likely at or near max gross. And so you're going to take off the very same conditions that's making this a perfect evening to watch the meteor showers are making it the worst possible scenario for taking off from a 4,000-foot runway with no moonlight at night, max gross, in your SR-22. So I think, you know, if I were this pilot, I don't think I'd award myself Mother of the Year award for that. And so if you're going on this adventure, you might as well throw a 20-pound tent in and make a night of it.
Wally, you're also camping. Tell me why.
Well, first of all, if I have to be worried about getting back and worried about fog, I'm not going to enjoy watching the meteorite activities. I'm going to be thinking more about that's going to spoil the adventure for me. So if I couldn't go out there and camp and enjoy the whole thing, I just don't think I'd go. The Cirrus is a capable airplane. We don't know how old these children are, but you could bring the camping gear. You don't have to have much fuel for this flight. It's 25 minutes each way. So the camping is my only option here, frankly, rather than it just spoils the fun for me if I'm constantly worried about the weather, running up the hill to see if I can get a telephone contact for an ASOS. A lot of things can change, and as Kevin talked about earlier, it's typical to have early morning ground fog there. To me, that's just it's just more comfortable to do it that way, or if I can't get the family to camp, then we'll stay home.
Paul, I'm going to give you your option, too. Why are you camping?
Well, for similar reasons to Catherine, but I read a great quote by Roald Amundsen, the famous Antarctic explorer. He said, adventure is just bad planning. And I really resonate with that. I do not want to spend a night in a FBO lounge or in the airplane. I've done both. It just kind of sucks. And to me, good planning is having certainty, is having something you can definitely depend on. So in this case, find the tent. Just get a tent. And if you're watching the meteor shower, you're going to be bothered by mosquitoes all night anyway. So if you're prepared for it and you have the tent, you have a definite plan. It's a safe plan. And that's what you're going to do. There's no doubt about it. And there's no uncertainty. And you go into that, you execute it, and you come out in the morning, you'll be more relaxed about it. You don't really have to think about it. And one aspect that is a little bit of a red flag here is that the pilot isn't instrument rated. Now, he may or may not need that, but at night, it's just better. It's just being better equipped and being better trained. So that's a factor for me, too.
Yeah, Catherine, I see you nodding there, and that actually is one of my next questions. How much does an instrument rating help here? People think about that, and you were nodding, Catherine, so I'll ask you, is an instrument rating really a gain, or with something like mist and fog, it's all going to go wrong probably between decision altitude and the runway anyway? That's kind of where you drop into the low-level fog and the visibility suddenly goes away. How much does it help?
Yeah, I don't think the instrument rating is going to help you deal with the fog. But the instrument rating, if you're bound and determined to take off from this runway, the instrument rating is going to help you throughout the flight. Because let's face it, you're probably not going to have any visual references on this evening. So you're going to be splitting your time looking outside and honestly flying instruments. So I think an instrument rating is huge for this flight if you're bound and determined to make it.
Kevin.
Just to build on that a little bit, I think that there's a couple of different factors with that. And I agree that you need the skill set to keep the greasy side down and to not run into a hillside. But I don't think that you necessarily need all of the tools that are necessary for an instrument rating. Our scenario pilot in the setup, it talked about the fact that he was working on his instrument rating and he was not quite there, but getting close. So I took that to mean that this pilot is capable of flying at night or in limited visibility, low visibility, if even if not legally IFR. In those sort of more challenging situations that are maybe pushing the limits of VFR, but are still legal VFR, that if you've got the skill set for it, then I think that's can be a reasonably safe thing, even if you don't necessarily have the rating on your certificate.
John.
To expand on my four with modifications, I'm all about adventure. I love the concept of this, of going out, and I've actually done this, although not flying, but spent the night out there looking at the Perseids. And I'm not adverse to camping and taking the camp. As a matter of fact, I'm recording this while I'm sitting in a camper. So that's definitely part of the fun of it. But I think I would prefer to lock down exactly what's going to happen that night. And to lock down, I mean, get the hotel room in Princeton. If you can't find a hotel room in Princeton, find another airport around there with good forecast and guaranteed accommodations. Stop there on the way, check in, pick up the key. So when you get back at 2 o'clock in the morning, you don't have to worry about finding a ride and all that. As Kevin said, having a solid plan in place lets you relax and enjoy the view. And I think that's what you need to do, is to tie up the loose ends with this early on and make sure you have a solid plan so you're not stressing about this. As opposed to sitting out there, as some of the other folks have said, sitting on the mountaintop, trying to get a cell signal, worrying about it. And the other piece of it is it is going to be 2 o'clock in the morning. There's fatigue. There's a good possibility of inadvertent IMC going back towards Bar Harbor, descending, and all of a sudden, poof, you're in the cat's paws of fog. So there's a lot of reasons not to do this, especially if you have a solid plan locked in. And if I couldn't lock in a solid plan, then I'd probably go with five and reconsider.
You know, Paul, I've heard a pilot who might look somewhat like you once say, "Why are you bother checking the weather? You're going to go anyway." And while it was tongue-in-cheek, there is something to be said for the weather changes. And as Kevin pointed out, you got to have a plan for if it's going to change. Do pilots worry about the weather hours or days out too much?
First of all, that quote related to flying night freight, and that's different. Different rules. I think we kind of do worry about it, particularly inexperienced pilots and particularly non-instrument rated pilots who might start trying to make a weather decision 2 or 3 days out, which is just about, well, depending on the weather, is almost impossible. But I think in this circumstance, what makes it different for me is you have the family along. You have people along who are expecting you to make a risk decision in their behalf, and they don't have the intellectual framework or the experience to understand all the elements you have to consider in that decision. And if it were two pilots on this, or you and I, for example, I would make possibly a different decision with regard to weather than I would if the family were along. But and I was going to mention this, you know, where we include the MOS, we include this QT, we're second-guessing people whose profession is weather forecasting. And to me, I've always assumed, okay, it's going to be the worst, and I'll have to deal with that. I don't assume that, well, it might not happen, and I'll go ahead and go, unless I have a really solid gold out or two in my back pocket. And I get back to the instrument rating here. To me, that's a real issue here. Here's a guy who doesn't have a lot of experience. He's in a fairly heavily loaded SR-22. And I just think being instrument rating, having some experience, just gives you that many more tools and options when you're confronted with a circumstance that's novel or unexpected.
With this kind of uncertainty in the forecast, one of the things that people recommend is the forecast discussions, and we have those included in the resources here. And they really give you some kind of insight into, you know, what the forecaster is thinking. I'm wondering how much anyone uses those in their big picture planning. Kevin?
For me personally, I don't look at the forecast discussion frequently, but I do sometimes. It seems like a lot of the time when I'm going flying, the weather is a bit more cut and dried, and whether it's good or bad. I think for me, if I'm looking at a TAF and then there's another nearby TAF that is different and I can't see exactly why it might be different, then I'll start to dig a little bit deeper. And forecast discussion is one of those things I might take a quick look at, but I wouldn't describe it as part of my routine planning. It's more if I think there's some a deeper look needs to be had at what the forecast says.
Wally?
Yeah, I don't use the forecast discussion I use it very little also. I like to start with broad charts just to get a general picture of the weather, and then I look at the TAFs and the MOS. And even in this case, it's my experience that the MOS is typically more optimistic than the TAFs, as it is in this example. So I would be inclined to be more attuned to that TAF today.
Yeah, there's lots of nodding around the table that the MOS is definitely more optimistic, it seems, than the TAFs, which have a human observer. I do wonder, and I actually don't have an answer on this. I know the TAFs tend to be more pessimistic when it comes to thunderstorms if it's an airport with commercial operations, because it has real implications for the commercial operators. I don't know if that's true for fog as well, but I suppose it could be. John?
Something that I've noticed with TAFs versus then actually watching the METAR a few hours later, especially in situations like this, is they will often forecast that 2 or 3 miles in mist, but it actually turns out to be like a few at 300. It turns into a layer rather than strictly a reduction in visibility. A reduction in visibility, in this case, 3 miles in mist at night, with an SR-22 lined up on the ILS, you know, with approach lights and stuff, wouldn't be too bad. But it's that 300-foot scattered or few layer that comes out of these coastal fog conditions that I see more often than not out of a TAF. I think there's a big difference between them.
You know, one of the things about this scenario that I think people will find is a surprise, you brought up, Kevin, about being on the wrong side of the fence after hours. If you don't regularly land at a commercial airport that has an airport that has commercial service late at night, you may be used to the typical airport where, even though there's a fence, the code is 135 or 121, and it's on the back of the gate. You just walk out if you didn't hop over it. These airports really are locked, like with padlocks. When we were talking about it, I believe you had a situation at Hanscom, I think it was, that was along those lines. I don't know if you wanted to share that little bit there.
Sure. I've had a couple of them, actually. I've had it happen at Hanscom Field, where we were stuck for, it wound up being a good couple of hours before we were able to get a hold of somebody. And we went through the process of calling fire department, called the overlying approach control, asked them to call their emergency contact, and the folks at Massport wound up being very difficult to get a hold of. Had a similar one on a charter flight that I did, and I was flying a passenger into, drawing a blank on, I want to say it was Republic on Long Island, but it might not have been. It was on Long Island either way. And it was, we were arriving after the FBO closed, and I was told that a person would be there and it wouldn't be a problem and we'd be able to get out through a fence. Well, the trick to getting through the fence was not obvious, and it took a little bit of doing to eventually open the gate so we could get the passenger out and on his way, and I could leave and go home for the night.
So as long as the trick didn't involve bolt cutters, that's kind of what you're talking
exactly
about. Paul?
Yeah, you know, I got caught once in mid-climb over the fence. It probably 2 or 3 in the morning. It was here at Venice at my home base before. This was before 9/11, but they had security gates. And there was no one around, and I couldn't get out. I'll just go over the gate. No one will come. Sure enough, when I'm at the top of that fence, up rolls the cop. And I talked my way out of it, but the lasting lesson was, I'm not doing that again. That's just not a good plan, because post 9/11, I'm not so sure that it would be so easy to talk your way out of it. So you really, if you're going to do that sort of thing, you really have had to work the plan out and have the phone numbers and know what you're going to do when you get to that lockdown airport, particularly if it's a Park 139 airport. I mean, it's almost shoot on site security. So you really have to have figured it out.
You know, fog, especially as you're cruising overhead, is just so tempting. You're looking down, you got this perfect view of the airport, and it's not until you get that sort of slant range coming in that you're like, man, where is that airport? You know, Wally, I know you are a big fan of personal minimums. Is there a personal minimum that could apply here for going back to Bar Harbor? And what might that be? How would a pilot avoid the temptation, coming full circle on this, of making that decision? Because that's really where this sits, to divert or not to divert. What do you think?
Well, the personal minimum for this pilot, he's a VFR pilot. So it's not IFR limits for sure. If that visibility gets down to 2 miles, that's lower than he should be flying. Back to having an instrument rating. In this case, I'm not sure an instrument rating would be all that much help. It certainly would make him a safer pilot, but unless he has had experience dealing with shallow ground fog, that's a whole different thing than making an instrument approach with a 400 or a 300 foot ceiling. It's, as you all know, it's very possible that at the outer fix, you're seeing the runway and all the lights and the approach lights, and it's not until you descend visually below published minimums often that you go into the fog and you go 0-0. And a VFR pilot digesting that and making a safe go-around from that situation is unlikely. I think that's a bad setup.
But is there a level for a VFR pilot? You know, I'm thinking you hear that, like I said earlier to Kevin, it's 5 miles in mist. It's 6 miles in mist. It's 4 miles in mist. You know, as you said, Catherine, this is night. The pilot is tired. Like, is there a way to apply? Is it appropriate to apply a hard number there?
Yeah, I think the personal minimum for this pilot ought to be good VFR to approach this airport. I don't think it should be anywhere close to marginal.
This would be a perfect example for a risk assessment tool, where you add points for each one of the risk factors. The FAA has a great one on their website with day and night minimums, currency, all sorts of things. And it gives you an empirical hard and fast number to assess the risk of this flight. And I think you might be surprised at how high the number would come out for a seemingly simple, easy VFR flight.
Yeah, it's a great point. And to me, that's part of what this scenario is it's a seemingly no-brainer scenario and just not a big deal. And yet, the more you sort of peel the onion here, there are a bunch of little traps in this very realistic and why we go flying scenario.